The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So now you can record, I think. We don't want people in Audio Dharma to hear all that. Because I've heard someone from my Audio Dharma world say, you know, these comments about the sound. Okay. So this evening I would like to read some passages from an ancient discourse from the time of the Buddha. And it involves what I think is a quite tender conversation between a husband and a wife. Mostly the wife is speaking to the husband. And it's partly tender, I think, because he's so gravely sick that it seems that he's about to die. And so she is giving him some advice or teaching to him a little bit. And it's also kind of meaningful because the woman who's talking to her husband is a very mature Buddhist practitioner. She has attained the first level of awakening, and so here we have a lay woman who is mature, quite mature in practice, and talking to her husband at a time that might be the last time she'll speak to him, perhaps. And so this is what she says to him. Well, this is how it goes. They're both named after their son. Their son is Nakula, and so the husband is the father of Nakula, which in Pali is Nakulapita, and the mother is Nakulamata, the mother of Nakula. Now, on that occasion, the householder Nakulapita was sick, afflicted, gravely ill. Then the housewife Nakulamata said this to him, "Do not die full of worry." To die full of worry is painful. To die full of worry has been criticized by the Buddha. It may be, O husband, that you think thus. After I'm gone, you won't be able to support our children and maintain a household. But you should not look at the matter in this way. I am skilled at weaving cotton and knitting wool. After you are gone, I'll be able to support the children and maintain the household. Therefore, do not die full of worry. To die full of worry is painful. To die full of worry has been criticized by the Buddha. It may be that you think thus. After I'm gone, Nakulamata will take another husband. But you should not look at the matter in this way. You know, husband, and so do I, that for the last 16 years we have led a layperson's celibate life. Therefore, householder, do not die full of worry. Do not die full of worry. To die full of worry is painful. To die full of worry has been criticized by the Buddha. It may be that you may think thus. After I'm gone, Nakulamata won't want to see the Blessed One, the Buddha, and the Sangha of monastics. But you should not look at the matter in this way. After you are gone, husband, I will be even keener to see the Buddha and the community of monastics. Therefore, husband, do not die full of worry. To die full of worry is painful. To die full of worry has been criticized by the Buddha. It may be, husband, that you may think thus. Nakulamatta does not fulfill virtuous behavior. But you should not look at the matter in this way. I am one of the Buddha's white-robed female lay disciples who fulfill virtuous behavior. If anyone has any doubt or uncertainty about this, the Buddha is dwelling nearby. They can go and ask him. It may be, husband, that you think thus. Nakulamatta does not obtain internal serenity of mind. But you should not look at the matter in this way. I am one of the Buddha's white-robed female lay disciples who obtain internal serenity of mind. If anyone has any doubt or uncertainty about this, the Buddha is dwelling nearby. They can go and ask him. Therefore, do not die full of worry. It may be, husband, that you think thus. Nakulamatta has not attained a foothold, a firm stand, assurance in the Dhamma and discipline. She has not crossed over doubt, gotten rid of bewilderment, attained self-confidence, and become independent of others in the teacher's teaching. But you should not look at the matter in this way. I am one of the Buddha's white-robed female lay disciples who have attained a foothold, a firm stand, assurance in this Dhamma and discipline. I am one of those who have crossed over doubt, gotten rid of bewilderment, attained self-confidence, and become independent of others in the teacher's teaching. If anyone has any doubt or uncertainty about this, the Buddha dwells nearby. They can go ask him. Then, while Nakulamitta was being exhorted in this way by his wife Nakulamatta, his ailment subsided on the spot. Nakulamitta recovered from that illness, and that is how his illness was abandoned. Then, not long after he had recovered, Nakulamitta, leaning on a staff, approached the Buddha. He paid homage to the Buddha and sat down to one side. The Buddha then said to him, "It is truly your good fortune and gain that your wife Nakulamatta has compassion for you, desires your good, and exhorts and instructs you. Nakulamatta is one of my white-robed female lay disciples who fulfill virtuous behavior. She is one of my white-robed female lay disciples who obtain eternal serenity of mind. She is one of my white-robed female lay disciples who have attained a foothold, a firm stand, assurance in this Dhamma and discipline, who has crossed over doubt, gotten rid of bewilderment, and attained self-confidence, has become independent of others in the teacher's teaching." So a little bit of a long passage to read, but I find it kind of remarkable, that passage of conversation of husband and wife from 2,500 years ago. And it seems that the husband is dying, and she teaches them about how to die not worrying about her. And to this day, we find in the hospice movement and places that the instructions, and when someone is dying, a close relative is dying, friend, that sometimes it helps them if you can reassure them that they don't have to worry, that the family is going to be okay, that it's okay for you to go. You have permission to go. And sometimes, in certain circumstances, when people are dying, people repeatedly say that. You can go, it's okay, we'll be fine, we'll take care of the kids, it'll be good. And only when they hear that is it easier for people to start letting go, because they're clinging and worrying about what might happen. So we have this example here. This idea of the Buddha saying that, don't die with worry, it's painful, goes with a kind of long-standing Buddhist idea that it's really good to die peacefully. That it's that's kind of the goal. And one of the purposes of mindfulness practice is to prepare for dying. It turns out that if you prepare for death, you're pretty well prepared to live also. They kind of go hand in hand. But traditionally, the mindfulness practice, the four foundations of mindfulness practice, was a practice supporting people, preparing people for dying, for a number of reasons. One is that it strengthens the mind so that the time of dying, which some people are afraid of, they're strong enough in their mind that they can stay present. Not only can they stay present, but they don't get swept away by their fears, they don't get swept away by their worries and concerns and angers or whatever it might be. And so there's a much better chance to die with serenity, as it talks about here, that Nakula Matta had serenity of mind. The part of the reason why people are encouraged in Buddhism to cultivate and develop mindfulness while they can is that it's a little bit too late to start doing it on our deathbed. But the idea is to prepare for that occasion. When I came, one of the first reasons that I came to Buddhism was because I was afraid of dying. And I didn't like that. And, I was pretty young. I was 20. But I was a little bit precocious, I guess. A little precocious that way. That thinking ahead, I guess. And so I was looking about for something that would help me deal with this fear of death. And eventually I landed upon Buddhism. And one of the remarkable things that happened was that in the course of my mindfulness practice, my meditation practice, that I had experiences of letting go, experiences of peace, that to the best of my guess, is comparable to the kind of letting go that I would like to have when I die. In fact, the deep letting go that I've experienced in meditation has led me now to, in a certain kind of way, to look forward to dying if I'm lucky enough to die slow enough and conscious enough to be there to watching it. I don't have no idea what death is going to be like. I don't know. I don't idealize it. I don't know if I'll be able to die peacefully or, I don't know how it's going to be. But what I do know is that I have this very strong association now with dying, with the idea of dying. Very strongly associate dying with what happens in deep meditation, which feels only good. It only feels really fantastic, wonderful. And if that's the time, if I could kind of continue that process of letting go as I'm dying, then it just... So it has to be good. It has to be one of the great things to go through. So whether that's the case or not, I don't know. But I can't recognize in myself any fear of death that I had when I was young. Don't I have fear of it, but there's a positive association about the whole process with it. So that's kind of interesting, I thought. So this, and I attribute that to this practice that we do here. Nakula Matta gave her husband a gift, the gift of saying, you don't have to worry. I'm capable. And it's quite a confident woman. I'm capable. I can manage fine without you. I have a livelihood I can live and take care of the family, myself. This idea of her being virtuous, I think, has a lot to do with not so much that she's supposed to be pure or something, But rather, in ancient, in the Buddhist tradition, if you live a virtuous life, then you're kind of taken care of spiritually. That and one of the ways you're taken care of is also is that in this ancient understanding, is that if you live a virtuous life, then you won't be reborn in a bad rebirth. So this was a high kind of value in the ancient world. So the husband didn't have to worry not only about the wife's livelihood or life this lifetime, but also future lifetimes. And then that she had serenity of mind. Maybe he was concerned about how she was going to die. And I've discovered peace in some deep way, she said. And then this amazing little passage in the end, that she's independent in the Dharma, that she has self-confidence. The whole description that I read there is a description of her being an awakened person. And wouldn't you want to have someone who's awakened minister to you when you're dying? Pretty cool that it's your wife or your spouse that does that. So, so I also thought I was kind of touched by this passage because it's a woman, and it's a woman who is a model for a certain level of spiritual attainment in Buddhism. It's also a model of a woman, at least in the context of the ancient world, where not only is she teaching her husband, but the Buddha praises her for doing so. It is truly your good fortune and gain that your wife, Nakulamata, has compassion for you, desires your good, and exhorts and instructs you. I kind of love it. Because in the ancient world, mostly we think of it being patriarchal, and women are not usually held up as examples of being teachers. And here, she's kind of, even the Buddha champions her as a capable teacher and instructor for her husband. I think partly I wanted to read this today because of this idea of dying. I talked to a series of people today who are involved in the field of death and dying and training to support people in their dying process. One person who is training to become a death doula, someone who is a doula is someone who's a midwife kind of, who supports people in their birth process, but now there's a field of death doulas, people who support people in the dying process. And having these conversations today kind of caused me to kind of review all the people I've sat next to in their bedside as they were dying. And what a profound experience it has been, most of those for me, to sit there and attend to people. There's something very precious, something very poignant and vibrant and alive, sacred, reverent, in the sitting at the bedside of someone, can be sitting in the bedside of someone who's dying or someone who's just died. And partly because it focuses the mind, partly because everyone involved is kind of right there. Most people's minds don't wander very far away and don't start wondering what's on TV and, you know, what's going on with sports or anything else. It's just like kind of there in a very full way. And that concentrated presence of people at that time, I think, is very powerful. And to be together, to accompany someone in that tenderness and the intimacy of this very powerful transition is kind of a privilege to be along for it. So today I was thinking about this and recalling it, and I was kind of like a little bit touched inside and all the people I've sat with and been with, and what a, you know, what a significant thing it is to be able to come along. And I thought about some of the people I've counseled. You know, it's one thing to tell the person who's dying that you don't have to worry. It's okay for you to go. It's okay. I love you. I don't want you to go. I'd like you to stay. But now that you're dying, I want to let you know that, yes, it's okay for you to let go. It's safe to let go. We'll be okay. You can go. That's one side. The other side is when the dying person does that in the other direction, that the dying person, that how they die is a gift to others. One of the really touching gifts is, you know, unfortunately sometimes parents die when they have still young children. And I remember one young woman who was, I knew her mostly from teaching retreats. She'd come on retreats with me, and over a series of years. And at one point she came and she had breast cancer. And so she was very determined, strong woman, and she was going to, you know, beat this and cure herself and get over it. And it's partly because, or mostly because, she had a young son, I think it was a young son, who I think was maybe like 8 or 9 years old. I saw her over a period of time, and she was working with this. And then at one point she came to a retreat with me and said, well, it doesn't look like there's a cure anymore. And I don't think I have that much longer. And I'm angry. I'm really angry. So I told her that that how you die is going to be one of the big influences on the life of your child. She was angry because of the sake of her child. That's why she was angry. If you die angry, that's going to set the course of your son's life, the whole life perhaps. It'll have a huge impact. But if you can die peacefully, that's a whole different impact that you can have. So then she left the retreat. And then a few months later, I got a phone message, a phone call from her husband, who said that she had died. And she died at home in bed, and that when she had died, she died peacefully, and when she had died, the father and the son went out in the garden and got a flower, came back in with a flower and put it on their chest. And then I knew that she had, I kind of figured from that, that yes, she had died in a way that was a gift for her child. I mean, it's tragic, right, to have a child lose its mother at a young age. So to say it's a gift is probably, you know, could sound kind of strange, but if a parent's going to die before the child, could it be a gift? Could it be something that's given? Certainly, it can be the opposite of gift. If the child watches the parent die, miserable and angry and frightened and anxious, I mean, that's a, you know, it's a powerful lesson, powerful example. But to have a parent die peacefully, maybe contentedly, or, you know, a certain kind of way, willing to let go, just be there, says something about a very different lesson, not only for about dying, but also for how to live as well. So my day was made up of a lot of thoughts and a lot of heartfelt feelings of these conversations I had and reminders of these things. And so then I thought of this story and that has kind of inspired me. So in Buddhism, there's a tradition that there are many, many different kinds of meditation practices a person can do. And many of these practices are appropriate for different circumstances. However, in this tradition, it says that there are two meditation practices which are universally useful for everyone, no matter what. And one of the universally useful meditation practices is the practice on loving kindness. So it's nice. Kindness, compassion. It's nice that that's considered universal. The other one is recollection of death. Death and dying. To spend time recollecting or considering or meditating on the topic of death. And so rather than ignoring it and keeping it at an arm's distance, it's encouraged to spend time contemplating and reflecting and being present for this whole inevitable destination we're all going to, our dying. And it's considered to be universally useful. And it's specifically said that it shouldn't be done in a way, this contemplation of death, is not to be done in a way that is grim or morbid or depressing. So look out for that. But rather, so somehow the experience is meaningful in a certain kind of way. I don't know if inspiring is the right word, but perhaps encouraging us to practice, encouraging us to stay present, encouraging us to really take this life of ours seriously, and from a Buddhist point of view, get to work. You know, we don't know when death is coming, and there's a wonderful work to be done in our practice, the Buddha practice of liberation, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of loving kindness, and for no other reason, because it prepares us for the inevitable death that comes. And if that doesn't motivate us, the possibility of death, to really value the life that we have, to really enter into it in a deep, strong way, in the way that mindfulness practice helps us to enter into it and touch it in some deep way, is also part of the one of the consequences of this reflection of death and dying. So when I spent a year of my life doing this contemplation of death practice, and it was very helpful for me. And I did it in a variety of ways, but the way that I did it every day, kind of like a regular practice, was I contemplated in the morning, soon after I woke up, that if I knew I was going to die that evening, how would I live the day? What would be most important for me? And I did that for a year, and it was fascinating to watch how my priorities change over time, to watch and see the different things that I would do. And eventually, what I kept coming back to, though, what I eventually came to, is the most common place my mind would go if I only had one day left, was I'd meditate. You know, I'd set my affairs in order, I would talk to people, do the things I had to do. But there was something about the meditation, sitting still and quiet in myself, that seemed like the most precious, most kind of poignant or most intimate or most connected, most valuable thing, most valuable way to be in the last hours that I have. And I think one of the reasons for that is that in meditation, not only do I sometimes feel more alive than I do any other time, but it's a kind of feeling alive in a way that feels deeply, intimately connected to a way of being or kind of reality or kind of a way of being that, is probably could be called sacred or could be called, sacred. You know, if I'm going to die, it's nice to be in the place that's most sacred, maybe, at least for me. So meditation is that place. So to contemplate death, to consider it, I've heard of Christian monks who live their life in a cell, monastic cell, where they have their coffin that they're going to be put in when they get buried. that's my wake up, and there it is. I always imagine that the coffin was open when they have it in their cell. I don't know if you know. And Buddhist monks, and also, and I went to Thailand. One of the things I encountered there was how many of the Buddhist monks that I had there did contemplation of death practice. They often had photographs of dead people on their walls of their little rooms, and so it's kind of frequent reflection, thinking about it a lot. Once a year, I take a group of people to an anatomy lab and spend time with a corpse. A group of, usually it's about 15 or so, 20 Buddhist practitioners. And it's quite touching to go. And some of the people who go have never been with a corpse. And the anatomy lab is particularly interesting because, you get to see the inside of the corpse. And that's quite something to see, the whole innards. And most of the people who do it leave the anatomy lab feeling they've been someplace that's of a sacred place. It's very reverent and beautiful to sit there. The woman who guides us gives a kind of a sense of being there in a way that's very respectful of the people who died. And these are people who donated their bodies to medicine. And it's quite a wonderful thing to kind of the stillness, the quiet, the care, the reverence, and the kind of contemplation, consideration of this is me, this is what will happen to me someday. I think most people who go along on the trip feel like they're a better person because of it. So maybe when it's your time to die, someone will be next to you and tell you, don't worry. Or perhaps when it's your time to die, maybe you have the occasion to let someone sitting near you, don't worry, I'm okay. And maybe no one will worry, you or your people, when you're dying. Perhaps you'll feel that this is the time of your life. Maybe not in the way we usually say that. Maybe not in the usual way we mean that in English, the time of my life. But boy, it will be a time in your life. And hopefully it's a time that's quite special and meaningful. For those of you who do regular mindfulness practice, I hope that you do it well and consistently and deeply in such a way that it does prepare you for your death when the time comes. So we have about 10 minutes, and if any of you have any questions, concerns, comments about this, testimonials, we can take a few moments.
Thank you for that talk. As you know, we live in an area that's quite obsessed with extending human life.
Extending life?
Human life.
There's an app for that?
There is. there most certainly is, I think. And so I was just curious to hear your thoughts about that. There's a lot of research that's being done around cancer and reversing aging and etc. How do you think about these concepts?
Yes, in principle, I think it's good to do medical research and be able to cure illnesses and things like that. That's good. I suppose it's good to have a life full of energy and But it does make me a little sad, this kind of stuff, because I think that there's something very meaningful and important about getting old in the way nature wanted us to get old. And sometimes it's painful, sometimes it's difficult, and the ravages of old age can be pretty hard for people. So I don't want to say it too flippantly, but you know, if we are old, if we just stay forever young, some people's idea of a good time is to stay forever young and then just die, you know, just rather than fade away into the sunset. But there's something very profound, I think, about the process of dying, the process of getting old, the process of beginning to lose our faculties, not be as strong or energetic as we have, you know, to have our faculties begin to go. There's something, there's very important lessons in it that some people don't learn any other way. Lessons of letting go, lessons of what's important, lessons of settling in. One of the very important people in my life was my great-grandmother. And I didn't know her hardly at all. But for a three-month period of time when I was about 20, I kind of lived on her apartment. It was a little tenement apartment building, a very narrow, small little place. And there was a stairwell that went up to the second floor. And the second floor consisted of her teeny kitchen, her teeny living room, and her teeny bedroom. And that was the whole second floor of this tenement little thing. And but then off the stairwell was a little room, and I was given that room. And every once in a while, I'd go visit her in a little living room, and she mostly we just sat in silence together. And at least the way I interpreted how she was very peaceful. Like, I'd sit in this room; the room was quiet and peaceful. There was a sense of love, of care, sitting there with her. I felt that she was content and not afraid, and there was a peacefulness to her that I hadn't known anybody else in my life up until that time, anything like that. And I'd sit there and have darshan with her, sit there and just kind of feel it, be with her. And it gave me a real sense of lesson in how to be alive in a certain peaceful, contented, silent way that was kind of sacred, kind of special. And I attribute it to her letting go into her old age, living alone, not being very mobile, that somehow she had learned how to let go. She had learned how to just kind of you know, she's gone through a lot of difficulties in her life. And so I think the process of aging is, for many people, part of the process of maturing. And if we stay forever young, we might have fun. But I think there's more important things than fun. And there's this whole maturing process, and that goes on. So, you know, so maybe we can take the sting out of getting old. Maybe some of the more horrible parts of it that really are debilitating. So maybe the research can kind of can help that. But I think it's important to get old. For those of us who are lucky enough to get old, and to kind of embrace it. I think it's the occasion for a lot of letting go, and every faculty you lose, just it's another occasion to let go. It's kind of like you're being handed. Look, let go of this too. Let go of this. This too. It's you know, as opposed to sitting in meditation, what do I let go of now? Yeah, I'm let go, but you know, when I was young, I thought when I was young and meditating and sitting in monasteries, and I thought, wow, I've let go so much. Boy, this is great. This letting go is great. I didn't know yet what I had to let go of. I didn't know what there was to let go of. And then as I got older, went through life all kinds of ways. Wow, this too? I didn't know you had to let go of this. Wow. Anyway, so is that a good enough answer?
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree. Thank you.
We have time for one more.
Again, thank you for this elegant talk. If you can speak to us a little bit about mourning.
Mourning?
Yes. And how do you comfort people who are mourning?
How do you comfort people who are mourning? You know, I don't think that... I don't want to... I can't answer your question the way you're asking it. I think it's a good question. And the reason I can't for myself is I don't think of myself as comforting people who are mourning. But rather what I think I do is I try to accompany them. And accompany them, be with them, and support them to be where they're at and allow whatever they're feeling, whatever is happening for them, to be recognized, to be seen, to be expressed. Go for a walk with people, let them talk what they want to say. But it doesn't occur to me to comfort them. Like, say it's okay, you know, it's all good. I don't think I want to, I'm not inclined to do that when someone is mourning and grieving. And I think part of the reason for that is that I think also like aging, I think grieving is also an important part of life. And that when there has been an important loss, I think it's a fairly natural thing to grieve. And that rather than comforting in a way to settle it or calm it down or make people feel better, I think it's generally wiser to support people to go through the grieving process in a healthy way. There is kind of healthy grieving, even though in the middle of the worst kind of grief, that you can't imagine that there's a healthy grieving, and you can't tell them. let's sit down and I'll tell you how to grieve healthily a loss of your spouse. You know, that doesn't work either, right? But I think just accompanying them and offer your presence, spend time with them. Okay? So, thank you very much. Some of you didn't expect to come here today and hear about death, dying. But this is a big part of life, an important part. And the whole Buddhist thing, that the Buddhist enterprise, the whole thing that Buddha set up, the teachings, it was a big part of it was in fact to address these kinds of existential issues. It wasn't about stress reduction. So, thank you.